All right. Well, yes, thank you for the introduction, Denise. So this is going to be a different talk from certainly those this morning and many of those in this week. So while the previous talks were looking at determining these structures directly from equations, Navier-Stokes equations, I'm taking really the opposite approach. I'm looking to determine structure directly from data, and for the most part, ignoring the equations, although we will use the structure of the equations at a couple points here when they're helpful. And I'm going to attempt to apply this to, well, maybe not turbulence, certainly not what most people in this room call turbulence. At least I'll apply it to fluids. And I have a couple of examples in turbulence, but you judge for yourself. So I also want to acknowledge the people who have done most of this work. So Scott Dawson, my former student, now is working with Beverly at Caltech, Matt Williams, who's now at UTRC, and my colleague Yannis Gavrikidis. Okay, so here's an outline of what I'll talk about. First, I actually will talk about a turbulent flow, a jet and cross flow, in order to introduce these ideas and tell you a little bit about these methods I'll talk about today, primarily dynamic mode decomposition and the Koopman operator. So then I'll go into much more detail on those in the middle of the talk. And then finally, I'll show an example of determining nonlinear models of fluid flows from data. Okay, so first as a motivation, I wanted to show this example, which is really what got me thinking about this in the first place, which was about 8 years ago, actually when I was here at UCSB on sabbatical. So there's a problem that these folks at KTH were looking at, which is this jet and cross flow. It's turbulent flow. Here's a snapshot of the flow. And they wanted to predict the various structures and frequencies in this flow. So you can find the mean flow. They also found an unstable equilibrium. They were linearizing about the unstable equilibrium. There's been a lot of discussion this week about what you should linearize about. Anyway, they linearized about this and found that this linear theory did not work well at all. Okay, so these Struhal numbers are the non-dimensional frequencies. Okay, there's a shear layer mode that looked okay, but this near wall mode didn't agree at all. So this is a big failure of the linear theory. So then we used this method, dynamic mode decomposition, and got a couple modes out of this. I'll tell you what these modes are about, but there were these two dominant modes, this high frequency mode with structures in the shear layer at this non-dimensional frequency, and a low frequency mode coupled to near wall structures. And these matched perfectly. Yes?
Say the linear theory, I missed, you're linearizing about the unstable equilibrium or about the mean?
This was about the unstable equilibrium.
Okay, you didn't try linearizing about the mean.
No,
no.
And it
okay.
May have worked better. I don't know. Yep. Okay, but the point is that this method gave something that looks reasonable and people would look at this and say, oh yes, I recognize those structures. That gives me some information about what's going on at this frequency, and at this frequency we have structures near the wall. Okay, and the main point I want to say is that we can use these types of ideas to separate the structured part of what's going on from the randomness. Okay, so that's a sort of a theme here. There's structure and there's randomness, and we want to figure out the structure. Okay, so this is not meant to be legible, but the point is there's many applications of this DMD in fluids, and many of these are to real turbulent flows. You can, if you can read, there's turbulent cavity flow, there's turbulent channels, there's shock layer turbulent boundary layer interactions. People have applied this method, DMD, to all sorts of flows. So okay, it's being adopted, that's great. I will say that nearly all of these, the use of this is very qualitative. It's just to look at these pictures that I just showed you and say, okay, I see there's a structure there that helps me understand something about this, but not much quantitative. And what I really want to do today and with this line of work is to answer questions, what can we do that's quantitative with these methods? Okay, so this method DMD, I didn't even say what it is. It's a dynamic mode decomposition. It's a method for approximating eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of linear dynamics. So you assume dynamics evolve linearly, given only some snapshots, some available measurements sampled from the system. Okay, and it was invented by Peter Schmidt. So it turns out that these DMD modes that I just showed you are related to a linear operator called the Koopman operator. So I need to tell you what the Koopman operator is. We had a talk about this last week, but most of you weren't there for that, so I'll revisit this. So here's on one slide what the Koopman operator is. So I need to introduce a little bit of structure. So there's a state space, that your system evolves on, and there's some discrete time dynamics given by a map I'll call T. Okay, so discrete time. Now we need to talk about, so the Koopman operator acts on functions on the state space. So I'll call V the vector space of functions from the state space to complex numbers. And an element of that function space we'll call an observable. Why? Well, we'll say a measurement at a particular state, x, is just the value f of x, if f is in this function space. Okay, so f is the whole function that maps you from states to just complex numbers. Okay, so the Koopman operator acts on that function space. It acts on functions. If you give it to function f, it'll give you back a function uf, and the value of uf at the state x is just f at tx. It's x one step through the dynamics. So it maps a function to another function. And it's easy to see this is a linear operator, by which we mean the standard sense of being a linear operator. If you take two functions, apply u to the sum of these, or scalar multiples, you just get the sum of uf plus ug. Okay, so we have this linear operator, and the idea is to analyze this linear operator to say something about the dynamics. Why is this useful? Well, we'll focus a lot on eigenfunctions of this operator. And one reason these are useful is that these determine coordinates in which the evolution is very simple. It's decoupled and it's even linear. So to see this, let's say we have dynamics governed by this. X at time k plus 1 is just t of x at time k. And there's the Koopman operator we wrote down in the previous slide. Let's say this Koopman operator has an eigenfunction phi with eigenvalue lambda. Okay, it's a linear operator, it can have eigenfunctions. Now let's define a new coordinate z, which is, so this will be a scalar, which is just phi of x at k. Then how does z evolve? Well, z at k plus 1 is just, that's the definition of z, plug in what x, how x evolves. Aha, that's just the Koopman operator applied to phi, but that's an eigenfunction, and we just get lambda times z of k. So the evolution of this new coordinate, which is defined by this Koopman eigenfunction, is linear. It's just zk plus 1 equals lambda zk. So very simple, and this represents a structured part of the nonlinear dynamics. It's structured in that it evolves in this very structured way, not in a chaotic way. So if u has enough eigenfunctions so that we can figure out the whole state x from values of all the different eigenfunctions, then that means there's a coordinate change in which the system is linear. So that's very structured. Of course, for chaotic systems, this is not going to be possible. There's not a full set of eigenfunctions. But the hope is that maybe we can figure out the structured part of this dynamical evolution by looking at these eigenfunctions. That's kind of the perspective that I'm taking here. Okay, so if we revisit this jet and cross flow, the idea is this mode at this frequency, this is going to evolve according to e to the I omega 1t, where omega 1 is determined by the Struhal number. And this low frequency one evolves according to this. So they're just regular, just really periodic solutions, these different periods. Okay, so next I'm going to tell you about how to get approximations of this Koopman operator directly from data. And this is really going to be a new perspective. So I've actually never talked about this way of explaining this or the end results to anybody before, so that you're the first audience to hear this. Mm-hmm. I hope it's useful. So the new approach is as follows. I'm going to talk about a data-driven inner product. And then I'm going to talk about a subspace S spanned by a set of observables. We'll get a projection theorem that says this set of all functions can be decoupled as a direct sum, S plus its orthogonal complement. And we're going to approximate the Koopman operator by projection onto this subspace, where we just got the projection defined by this projection theorem. So this is actually a new way of thinking about this. However, a spoiler alert, in the end, we're going to get the same numerical method as DMD, actually this extended DMD. So it's a bit of a disappointing, bit of a letdown in the end, in a way, because it's not a new numerical method. But the path we take to get there is different. So why take this new path? Well, for one thing, I think this derivation I'm going to show you is a bit more natural and less ad hoc than what we knew previously. But also we'll be able to say more about this correspondence between DMD and the Koopman operator. So I'll show you a few nice results about that correspondence. Okay, so here's the setting. As before, we have a state space and discrete time dynamics. And we'll again consider a vector space of functions from M to C. Okay, those are the observables. And I'm not going to assume anything about these functions, right? That's not going to be L2, we don't know an inner product, it's not going to be a norm space, nothing like that. but we'll have an operator, the Koopman operator, on this function space. Okay, just as before. So this is, there's nothing new here. So now say we have a few observables, F1 through Fn. So these are, we think of as our measurements of the system. So at a particular state, we've got n measurements corresponding to those values, Fj, at that state. So that's stuff we can take from an experiment or simulation. Now the goal is to determine an approximation of this Koopman operator directly from data that we'll sample without actually knowing this map T explicitly or U explicitly. All we know is the data. But what we'll do, and it seems almost impossible that you could do this, but it works out naturally, we'll obtain the projection of U onto the subspace spanned by this. Now I need to say what a projection even means. There's no structure on V yet, so I don't have any projection. But to do that, we can define an inner product. We'd like to define an inner product. So we're just going to define an inner product structure based on data, and it's just this. So this is the kind of the main idea. Once you do this, everything else just follows very naturally. So let's say we have sample points. We have m sample points, states in our system. For any two functions on that state space, we define this thing that looks like an inner product. This is an average of this sum, f at xk times g bar at xk. So, all right, it satisfies many of the properties of an inner product. It's actually only positive semi-definite, but we'll see that works out okay. Why is this natural? Well, one way to see it's natural is let's say that m is the state space is a probability space. It has some probability measure mu. And let's say we draw these sample points randomly according to that probability distribution. Then by the law of large numbers, this definition converges to the usual inner product on L2 with that measure as m goes to infinity. So it's actually a natural inner product to define as for that reason. Similarly, if these points are just sampled from a measure-preserving ergodic dynamical system, then and you, as in the limit as these points go to infinity, again, you get back this inner product. So I would argue it's a natural inner product, but it's based only on data. Okay, so what data do we have? We have these n observables, these measurement functions we choose, and we have m sample points. So that gives us an m by n matrix of data, which we write in that form, that matrix X. Okay, now what's the subspace? We'll consider a subspace here, which is just the span of these observable functions. That's the subspace we're going to project the Koopman operator onto. And we'll also consider its orthogonal complement here, which is all functions orthogonal to that subspace. And we just defined our inner product. So now we need, there's a condition. So first, one thing to note, the rank of this matrix can't be more than n. It only has n columns. And it actually can't be more than the dimension of the subspace here. If these functions are linearly dependent, the rank is, the dimension of that's gonna be less than n. This can't have rank more than that. But if the rank equals the dimension of the subspace, then we have some useful properties we can say. So for one thing, actually this inner product is strictly positive definite on the subspace. And as a consequence of that, we get a projection theorem, which means that for any function in our function space, we can write it uniquely as a sum of a function in S and one in S perp. And that's what lets you define the projection onto the subspace S. So with that, we can define a projection P from all functions to our subspace. So that's the definition of the projection we use. And throughout, I'm going to assume that this rank condition holds. So we have enough data points. So each row of this matrix is a new sample point. If the rank is not n or the dimension of S, we should take more data points. And then you can apply this, what I'm saying. Yeah, if this rank is not S, then neither of these things is true, and you can't even define the projection uniquely. So, okay, so, all right, now here's the main result, how to project this Koopman operator. So now I need more data. So I have these data points, but also I have the data points, the values of those measurement functions at the following time step for each of those data points. So I now have two matrices, X and X, what I'm calling X sharp, which is the value of all those at the next step. Okay. Still have the subspace spanned by these n observables, still have the rank condition, I've got the projection. This is just notation. I'm defining a map from n complex numbers to my subspace just by taking this V is the in Cn. So those coefficients just times those basis functions, and I get an element of the subspace. So here's the big theorem. So if A is this matrix, X pseudo inverse times X sharp, then for any V, this is true. So what is this little thing? This is actually kind of amazing. So V is a vector in Cn. Okay, F of V is now a function in our subspace. U of F of V gives us a Koopman operator applied to that, and P projects it onto the subspace. Okay, so this gives us an element of that subspace. It's just the projection of the Koopman operator acting on that function. Well, that's the same thing as if I take V, multiply the vector by the matrix A, and then get the corresponding function. So in other words, this matrix A, X pseudo inverse times X sharp, is literally the matrix representation of the projection of the Koopman operator onto this subspace. Yes.
Denise Game, Johns Hopkins. So you're not assuming anything a priori on your observables, like that they have certain properties about the underlying dynamics here?
We're assuming nothing at this point. That's right. Yeah. If you choose bad observables, this projection might not be very useful. You're projecting onto a bad subspace. But you're right. I'm not assuming anything about them at this point. So this is true exactly. There's no residual. There's no approximation. There's no nothing. Okay, so another way of seeing this is that this diagram commutes. You can start with a vector in Cn and hit it with A. That's the same as getting the corresponding function, applying the projected Koopman operator, and then going back to a vector. Okay, and the nice thing to observe is this matrix is determined solely from the data. It depended only on our measurements. We didn't need to know the map T with operator U. And just want to point out this is computed exactly. There's no error in the approximation. Okay, so I said this ends up, the spoiler alert was this ends up being the same as DMD. Yeah, so this matrix we get turns out to be identical to the matrix you get with extended DMD. So it was shown in that work that this corresponds to an approximation by a weighted residual method, particular choice of test functions, which was, seemed a bit ad hoc. Here we see that A arises naturally as a Galerkin method with this choice of inner product. I'll also point out that standard DMD is a special case of this, where you take the observables to be the full state. So if your state is n-dimensional, you take n observables. And then actually the DMD modes are the left eigenvectors of A. We were looking at the right eigenvectors of A here, which are correspond to the Koopman eigenfunctions. Okay, so I want to look at a few. I promised that we'd be able to say something better by looking at it from this point of view. So what if we have an eigenfunction that lies in our subspace? Well, here's a little corollary. If U phi is lambda phi, that means we have an eigenfunction that lies in our subspace, then we're guaranteed there's a vector such that, so we have an eigenvector, AV equals lambda V, with the same eigenvalue, and phi is just the corresponding function. So this is actually very nice. If we have a Koopman eigenfunction in the subspace, we're guaranteed to be able to find it with this method. Right, there will be a corresponding eigenvalue and eigenvector, and then again, that's exact. There's no approximation. Now, this is actually previously known also. It was in this paper a couple years ago. So, okay, this is nothing new. But the next thing really is new. So what if this subspace S is invariant under the action of the Koopman operator? So what does that mean? That means if you have any function F in the subspace, then UF is also in the subspace. So if that's true, then you get this result, which is quite surprising and powerful. So this says that whenever V is an eigenvector with eigenvalue lambda, then you get a corresponding eigenfunction of Koopman with eigenvalue lambda. Again, no approximation. These are exact. So so any eigenvalue of A will be a Koopman eigenvalue. And the corresponding eigenfunction will be a Koopman eigenfunction. Exactly. So it's useful to compare this with, there's a recent result by Igor and his student Hassan where they looked at a special case where you had an ergodic system with this choice of observables. This corresponds to time delay coordinates or Tauchin's embedding. And you took sample points from iterating an ergodic dynamical system. And they showed that, again, under this assumption that S is invariant, in the limit of infinite data, you get these eigenvalues and eigenfunctions from DMD converge to Koopman eigenfunctions. So that's a very nice result. But this corollary actually strengthens that in several ways. So for one thing, we show that the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions are computed exactly. So there's no convergence. And we need only a finite amount of data just so this rank condition holds, not a limit as m goes to infinity. And we didn't have any assumption about ergodicity or anything. So this is actually, it seems very, you know, maybe small, but I think it's quite a powerful and new result here. I think Dwight had a question.
Dwight Barclay, University of York. Just a quick question. Is there any hope of knowing whether S is invariant just from the data?
Well, that's the catch, yeah. I mean, that's very difficult to check, yeah. And you need to, actually, you need to have some special, yeah, like a chaotic system that won't be true, right? But then the hope is that if S is close to invariant, maybe you get something that's close,
or
yeah.
You have an estimate where you do it with three dot spaces where you also get out a data estimate of how nearly invariant.
Yeah, you can do that, and there are, you can actually show, I'm not going to say this here, but you can show that if S is close to invariant, then this eigenfunction is in a pseudo spectrum. So lambda is in the pseudo spectrum of this projected operator, and the corresponding eigenfunction is in the pseudo spectrum. So that's maybe a useful result.
Maybe I'll just, John Gibson, New Hampshire. So I understand N now that you've put it up in a sort of delay embedding Tokens theorem kind of. Can you take me back to what that means in your formulation?
Yes, so in my formulation, these can be any observable functions. So here, this the idea. This was one, let's say the state is a velocity field. F of the velocity field might be the velocity at one point in space. And these would be delayed values. Yeah. But I'm saying you could have, and these don't need to be, in my formulations, don't need to be delays of one measurement. They could be any arbitrary
measurement.
Okay,
so what I'm trying to understand is, why are you not telling me that I can put a probe in a fluid and from n measurements of that probe tell you what it is tomorrow? And, you know, I understand from the Tokens case that's because n has to be 2n plus 1, 2n prime plus 1, where m prime is in the dimension of the dynamical system.
Well, the key is actually Dwight's point is that it's really hard to check if this subspace is invariant. So if you just take those n measurements, those n measurement functions are not going to be invariant to the Koopman operator.
It's a linear, because S is a linear span.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so this has limited applicability, but it's still a result. Yeah.
Just one little comment. In the result that you point out, because you're using ergodicity in the basin of attraction, you don't need to make that assumption a priori, right? Igor Mezich used CSB.
Which assumption?
So the, and this is what I think John is referring to. This is Hankel DMD method, right? So
right,
if you're taking samples of the function, which I presume is the case over there as well, but I'm not 100% sure. Is that on the function space or on the space of, so it's phi, so.
Is what the function space?
This result in the middle says something about taking sample points, right?
This here, yes. This is
yes,
the result. Yeah.
It takes actually sample points and sticks them into a matrix.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and it utilizes ergodicity to show that Hankel DMD converges.
Right. This is independent of, so that's why this is actually a stronger result. You don't need, in this result, you don't need the assumption of ergodicity, and you don't need to take these particular observables, which make it into a Hankel matrix. So my matrix is not a Hankel matrix.
Yeah, but you're replacing it with the fact that you know the full function in there.
No.
Then in principle, you have to do a set of samples. Maybe we can take it later.
Yeah,
in principle, you need to take a set of samples in order to make sure that.
No. I mean, there's no convergence. As long as this, that's exactly my point. As long as this rank condition is satisfied, this is exact. Yeah. It's exact, yeah. Okay, so just an example, and I think I only have 7 minutes left. Okay. I showed this example last week at a talk, so I'm going to skip this. This was an illustration of, should I not skip this? Okay, I won't skip this. All right. So this is an example in just a very simple 2D map. Okay, so has an equilibrium at the origin and then two invariant manifolds. One is the vertical axis, the other is this parabola, and C describes how parabolic this is. Okay, so for C equals zero, it's just flat and a linear system. Okay, so this system has two Koopman eigenvalues, actually an infinity of Koopman eigenvalues, but these are two of them. And here are the corresponding eigenfunctions. So one thing to point out, and you can just verify that if you plug in phi of this map times x, you get lambda times phi lambda of x. Actually, that's very easy to see because the map is just x1. So it just maps to lambda x1. And similarly here, if you plug that in, you just get mu times phi mu. So what I've drawn over here now is in this little gray lines is level sets of phi lambda, which are the vertical lines, and phi mu. So these level sets of Koopman eigenfunctions describe coordinates. You could think of it as curved graph paper. And on these coordinates, the system appears linear. This is just the result I showed, I stated earlier. So, so this just says you also get products of any of these eigenvalues and products of the eigenfunctions. Okay, if you apply DMD to this, let's just pick some values for lambda and mu. And let's start with just the regular DMD, which would mean, okay, we have two states. We have, let's take the full state as the observables. You almost couldn't imagine why you'd want more than the full state. Well, okay, let's start with a case where C is zero, so the problem really is linear. Then DMD gives us these eigenvalues, 0.9 and 0.5, which is perfect, exactly spot on what we wanted. Okay, but now if we make the problem nonlinear, make it a parabola, C equals 1, now the DMD eigenvalues are 0.9. Okay, we got that one perfectly. But then we get 2.002. So first of all, that doesn't match any Koopman eigenvalues, and it's even unstable. So we'd say, come to the wrong conclusion that we have an unstable equilibrium when it's actually stable. So what's going on here is that this, this eigenfunction corresponding to 0.5 is this. And this is not in the span of our observables. Our observables were only x1, x2. We didn't have x1 squared, right? So our theorem that we just said does not apply. So if we add x1 squared, now this subspace is invariant, although that's hard to check, as Dwight pointed out. And now we get perfect DMD. All of these eigenvalues, as are guaranteed by this result, agree with Koopman eigenvalues, and the eigenfunctions agree also perfectly. Okay, but of course we can't just be naive about adding random observables. If we add x2 squared, that doesn't help us. Still, the eigenfunction corresponding to that is not in our space, so we don't get that at all. We get DMD eigenvalues 0.9, 0.822. Okay, that's not so bad, but this one is again unstable, and we're get a bad result. Okay, so this says that the choice of observables really is critical for this method to work. That's not a simple thing. So some possible choices, orthogonal basis functions, Fourier modes, Chebyshev polynomials, things like that, reasonable. You could take Ulam's method, is to take indicator functions on small subsets of phase space. So the function is 1 if you're in the subset, 0 if you're out of the subset. Or spectral elements are combining those two. So you take subsets and define basis functions on each little subset. You could take these time delay coordinates, which is a Tokens embedding, as we looked at on the previous slide. Radial basis functions, I'll show an example, and your idea here, so you can pick your favorite set of basis functions here. So maybe I'll show one other example, this Duffing example, to show how these work, although I did show this last week. I will skip this example. It's a nice example to illustrate this, but if you're interested, you can, there's a video of the talk from last week you could look at. I want to say just a quick touch on this last point here, because it finally gets around to fluids. Okay, so the idea is we want to extract nonlinear reduced order models of fluid systems from data. So we have Navier-Stokes equations, and we want to use some of the structure of these Navier-Stokes equations. So we'll use them in two ways. One is to guide the choice of observables. The other is to enforce conservation properties of this equation. Okay, so let's project the velocity field onto a set of basis functions here, POD modes. So let's say these are POD modes. Any old basis functions will do. Then if we project the Navier-Stokes equations onto these, we'd get dynamics that look like this. And the only thing I am going to use here is the fact that this is quadratic. Okay, so L is linear, B is bilinear. So we have, everybody knows the Navier-Stokes equations have a quadratic nonlinearity. Okay, so it makes sense to choose observables that have quadratic couplings of POD coefficients. So let's just write those as the observables, all the POD coefficients plus all quad, this just means all quadratic terms, combinations of POD coefficients. And we'll do the same sort of thing, just trying to fit a linear operator now to this data. And we get a matrix that looks very much like the matrix we got when we approximated the Koopman operator. So if you do that to get this model, this is now a linear model in these nonlinear variables, which you can unwrap to get a quadratic, a nonlinear model, then we get a model that actually works very well. So this is just a cylinder flow. We collect data going from an this is the equilibrium, an unstable equilibrium of the cylinder, which winds up to a periodic orbit. The black is the true DNS. The pink is a standard Galerkin projection. And the blue is this data-driven fit, if you like, this approximation, which you call extended DMD model. And it fits better. You can look at cases where you have noisy data. Okay, it works much better than Galerkin here. If you have noise, that's Galerkin projection goes, it becomes a stable fixed point. Okay, spatially limited data. So now this is where we take data only in this tiny box, and their Galerkin projection blows up. Temporally limited data, so data only in this window, it works well there too. Finally, we can look at this constraint. So there's this constraint that the quadratic terms are energy preserving. We can enforce that too using just a standard Lagrange multiplier approach and get better models too. So this is a case where this, both these models look very good here. But if we start with an initial condition here at the about the mean of the periodic orbit, then the standard least squares model does something unrealistic. So black dashed is the true data, but the one with energy conserving constraints works much better. So it somehow makes it more robust. So the message there is simply, if you know the structure of the equations, it pays to use them. Okay, so I'll put up my summary there and happy to take questions.
Svitanovich, Georgia Tech. How is this related to, you know, long, long ago work of Kahneman, which turned nonlinear problems into linear? It looks similar.
Yeah, this last example here is essentially the same thing as Kahneman linearization. Yeah, so in Kahneman linearization, you take just nonlinear functions of the state and write a linear model for those nonlinear functions. That's essentially what we're doing here, just identifying these models from data. Yeah.
Denise Game, Johns Hopkins. So is it similar to subspace identification as well? Is that?
I'm not sure I know what, so tell me what you mean by subspace identification.
Offline.
Yeah, okay.
Ismail Hamzuddin, Johns Hopkins. Going back to Petrak's question, so I can do Kahneman linearization for the Navier-Stokes.
Oh, what right? About Kahneman linearization for Navier-Stokes?
I can do that on the Navier-Stokes, right? So is that, well, I can't, I won't be able to truncate it, maybe.
Yeah, that's the trouble, is that with Navier-Stokes, I mean, with any system that has chaotic or turbulent dynamics, whenever you apply the right-hand side, you're going to generate more nonlinear functions, right? So.
Suppose I could get infinitely many. I could extend the Kahneman linear. I'm not truncating it. Would that then be a Koopman operator?
I think that's probably right. I mean, there's certainly a connection there. I don't know if it's correct to say that is the Koopman operator, but there's certainly a connection there. Yeah.
So precisely theorem. Kahneman linearization is just a projection, well, utilizing polynomial bases to represent the Koopman operator. So that's a precise connection. But the other question that I had is maybe going back so that we can clarify the relationship between the two results. A that you have in the corollary needs to be known exactly, right?
You get it from data. So if that's what you mean by known, then.
Right. So how do you know that A is precisely the A that acts on that subspace? invariant subspace.
So that comes from this rank condition. So I assumed here that the rank of this data matrix always equals the dimension of the subspace. Okay, so you need to gather enough snapshots, yep. M, yep. So that this rank is at least N.
So that was kind of what I was trying to point
out. So that's related
out.
To, that's certainly that related kind to the limit. Yes, yeah. So in the previous result for an ergodic system, you needed to take M going to infinity. And the result was that as M goes to infinity, the eigenvalues converge. But really what you can say is that you don't need M to go to infinity. M just needs to exceed some threshold. As soon as it exceeds the threshold where this rank condition is met, you get everything exact.
Very fair point. Yeah. And the relationship between the two, I think, is clarified precisely because you need to take enough data in one. If you take the ergodic theory context, then you can actually do the same result for an infinite dimensional invariant subspace. And the Kronecker factor, which is the part of the Koopman operator that has eigenfunctions only, can be infinite dimensional, like if you have tori or something like that.
Sure, yeah, but then you need to have an infinite dimensional Koopman operator on the infinite dimensional subspace, right? You're talking about this, like infinite dimensional Krylov subspace.
Yes, but you do have a candle on truncation. This is the discussion with somebody else, where the tail actually decays exponentially, like mm-hmm. in the kind of theorem on tori that I showed last week. Anyhow.
Yeah.
Daniel Laquine, Princeton. So this Lopez cylinder problem, it's kind of remarkable that you can do with this. So I want to try to understand better why it works so well. So it seems like I can see that there's two things that's going on. One is you're using this POD expansion, and then you're augmenting your observables by putting in quadratics. So is this kind of the statement that the POD is really useful, and in what other problems would something break down and it would work quite so well? It's like, well, what's the limits of this approach?
Yeah, difficult question. What are the limits? I mean, I'm hopeful it will work for many more problems. POD certainly was very useful in this. So, and we gathered these. I didn't say much about that example, but if we just projected onto three POD modes here, let me go to that cylinder example. Yeah, so we projected onto three POD modes. These are the three modes, A1, A2, A3. And the fact that this works so well really is because those three POD modes happen to contain almost all the interesting dynamics of this pretty simple fluid flow, right? So if you have a more complicated fluid flow, you need many more POD modes. And then this does not scale very well, because if you have n squared POD modes, you need, or n POD modes, you need n squared quadratic couplings of them, or n times n plus 1 over 2, something like that. So that's not going to scale well as n grows. So part of the reason this worked well, yes, was that n was very small. N was 3 here.
Just follow up. So have you tried at all where n is like 10 or 50? I mean, because 3 is really small.
3 is really small, yeah, I agree.
10 is also pretty small.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so it's certainly computationally tractable. How well it will work, I've not looked into it. Yeah.
Predrag Cvetanović, Georgia Tech. Another question, like the Kalman question. In computational neuroscience, data looks very much like your data. There is some part of the brain which is very high dimensional, and then there is a finite number of observables. And then one uses this to reconstruct, let's say, motor cortex stuff. And one uses methods of constructing a lower dimensional manifold called isomap methods. Does any of this have any relation to what people do in computational neuroscience? Yeah, it looks very much like it.
Okay, so I'm not familiar at all with that field or that literature, and I'd love to talk to you about that and learn about it. I'd love to find connections. That would be very nice. Yeah.
I'm not expert with relative pretty much, but I have a question because I am surprised about the fact you say we take any POD modes. I know the case of the vortex shedding, and I remember if you don't take the zero mode or the shift mode, what is called in PLD, you don't recover the, neither good frequency, neither the circulation length, because it's the distortion of the mean field. So you need, it's not the same take any PLD mode. If you need absolutely include the zero mode or shift or like or this.
Yes, I agree completely. Actually, that's we ended up doing that because, see, we're collecting data between, we're starting very close to the unstable equilibrium, which is here. And then taking data that, you know, watching the system as it moves from that unstable equilibrium to the limit cycle. So the shift mode will appear in that data set. And that's, in fact, this A3 turns out to be the shift mode. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I will say something. But, okay, I had the same. Is it not because you included the quadratic interaction that you would have picked that up anyway, because that shift mode is the quadratic interaction?
Yeah, no, that's true.
It's only, let me just say, for the, as you, I'm sure, well aware, the cylinder wake really is just a three-dimensional problem. So that's
yes,
why you
that's right.
get
yeah.
it so well.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing, I'm just saying that.
No, no, point taken, absolutely. That's why we started with it, because it was a simple thing to start with. Yeah, I mean, that's why the Galerkin projection does work well. This, you know, data-driven method seems to work a little better, but yeah.
Yeah, but my question was, with regard to Eduardo's, is because you do the quad, because you included the quadratic interaction, would you have had to run it from there? Wouldn't the just the quadratic interaction have given you the shift mode?
Oh, you're saying, what if I just took data from this limit cycle?
Yeah. And then took the quadratic, and then took the quadratic, then took the product of those two modes.
It's possible. I haven't thought about that. So you think we might be able to get a two mode model, not a three mode?
No, no. You have to have three modes. But well, you have. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Ismail Hamdoudin, Johns Hopkins. So the in terms of practically implementing it, it seems that you need to find a good basis in terms of your observables to map the state space, right?
That's right, yeah.
Right? And so this is a bit more speculative question. Is there a rational way to find these observables given what we know about invariant solutions and everything we know about, is there a way to do it? I'm thinking maybe cycle expansions, but I mean, that's doesn't have to be.
Yeah, there could well be. It's not a question I've thought much about, but that would be really interesting to think about. You know, if you knew some invariant solution, could you use that to, you know, construct an observer? Yeah, I think that would be really neat to think about.
Yeah. Before we close the session, I just want to remind everyone there's an extra talk. Stefan is going to speak after Ed this afternoon, so at 4:45. So just remember there is an addition to your schedule today. And let's thank all the wonderful speakers from this morning.